Kendra.
Yes.
We've had a lot of conversations about lemon bars.
Uh-huh.
Before you develop them, after you've developed them, mm-hmm. and we're here.
And during.
And during, yeah, sorry, no,
while.
Gosh. I forgot maybe the most important part. And here we are, still talking about lemon bars, yeah. like 6 months later.
Yeah.
Hey there, listeners, future callers, and cooking enthusiasts. This is Dinner SOS, the show where we help you save dinner, or whatever you're cooking. I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious. Now, as you know, most weeks on the show, we field calls from home cooks who have had some kitchen fails. But this week, the fail is coming from inside the house, so to speak. I'm joined here by Kendra Vaculin. Hi, Kendra.
Hello.
I'm delighted to have you here today. And here's the plan. We're going to take a video you did for our How I Develop series back in the fall, and I'm going to make you watch parts of it back.
Oh, my
really
God.
Relive that experience.
It's going to be fun, I think.
But first, I want to talk a bit about what it is we do up there in the test kitchen when there aren't any cameras pointing at us. And, you know, I don't know if folks know this, but our test kitchen is where we develop and test every recipe that gets published, notwithstanding a handful of recipes that we do that are excerpted from cookbooks, particularly for Epicurious. But generally speaking, all the recipes that appear in the magazine, on the website, they've been developed, touched, cross-tested, interacted with in our test kitchen in One World Trade on the 35th floor.
Yeah. It is kind of crazy. Like when people come into the kitchen to develop a recipe for the first time, who maybe work on our editorial side and like have this amazing idea for a recipe or a new contributor, we often have to have a discussion with them that's like, this is called a test kitchen for a reason. If you do it the first time and it's not spectacular, you're not a failure. You're one of us. This is how it goes. Like you're trying something new. You're putting something new into the world that has never existed before. If it worked perfectly on the first try every time, you would be a savant. Like, I don't know, that's not normal. It should be wacky because you're pushing the limits and messing up and burning things and trying things a little bit crazier or outside of the box is part of the game. So that is built into the job.
And the process involves tons of feedback from everybody around you. And I think some of the folks who have done best in this environment over the years were the ones who had great ideas, but were also the most open to feedback. And being willing to engage in that process of interrogating their own work and interrogating the work of others.
Totally. The recipe that you pitch is almost never what ends up coming out the other end and being published online or in the magazine, because it goes through so many layers of people being like, what about this? What about this? And if you are so rigidly married to your original pitch, the recipe will be worse for it.
And the editing and feedback process starts long before you pick up a whisk or pick up a knife.
Oh my God, yeah.
It starts long before you have a blank piece of paper in front of you in the test kitchen.
We're having theoretical conversations about, Chris loves to say, I'm just asking the question. So if you pitch something and he'll be like, does it need ice cream? I'm just asking the question. And you have to think, does it?
Yeah, because ultimately we're all good enough cooks to be able to make the thing. But are we good enough cooks and are we good enough editors and editors of our own work and of our own minds to be able to truly create the version of the thing that our audience wants and needs? All that to say,
yeah.
When we come into the test kitchen, we taste a lot of things that are objectively delicious.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the question actually is, could they in fact be better?
And there is also like the level of what problem is it solving?
Exactly.
Like, the recipe might be delicious, but did it use 6 pans? Or does it take 1,000 years and it doesn't need to? Or could it be just as good with 2 fewer ingredients or without the fancy ingredient or, you know, XYZ thing? There's so many little tweaks that you can make to make a recipe. You know, not every recipe has to be super fast, super easy, one pot, whatever. But taking all of that into consideration for every recipe is important because ultimately we are at the service of the person who is cooking at home. making a recipe really good for each other, we could do that every day. It doesn't matter what we can do. It's what the person who has the paper recipe in front of them at home can replicate.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I do think there was this tendency years back at BA to be so in conversation with what's happening in the restaurant world and in the food world, sort of broadly speaking, that rather than interpreting that knowledge for a home cook audience, we were more just kind of recreating it, you know?
Yeah. I have this conversation with my husband all the time with regards to like what's a restaurant dish and what is something that we would make at home. I'm probably never going to make soup dumplings at home. I know how to do it. You use the little gelatin and you set the thing and then you cut the cube and then you wrap it in the dough and then I'm never going to do that. I could, but I'm not going to. And conversely, I'm probably not going to order a wedge at a restaurant because I think I could make a really good wedge at home. There's like this sweet spot of like where I feel like I can nail it and when I feel like I need a professional to nail it. And there's just this really hard line for me. And so I try to think about like, where can I get as close to the other thing as possible? Really give people like an amazing recipe where they're like, man, I could eat this at a restaurant, but I made it and that feels great. But the effort and the time and the technique that they put into it doesn't feel laborious or like it teeters into we ask them to, you know, be a restaurant chef for the night.
We're going to take a short break. When we get back, Kendra and I talk about lemon bars and her harrowing 2 days of developing her recipe on camera.
Hello, parents, homeschoolers, and teachers. Trusty Narrator here from the Who Smarted podcast. Our 15-minute episodes are perfect for car rides, bedtime, break time, class time, or anytime. We make learning science and history fun and funny for 7 to 11-year-olds with new episodes every week. Look for Who's Smarted on any podcast platform or at whosmarted.com. And teachers get a free subscription to our ad-free version by clicking educators at whosmarted.com.
Welcome back to Dinner SOS. Okay, so the video we're going to talk about in just a few seconds is from a series called How I Developed.
I spent the last 2 days making all these lemon bars so that I could make this. It takes a lot of trial and error to make a recipe worthy of being published on Bon Appetit. Today, I'm going to show you how I developed my perfect lemon bar.
And this series brings to life the recipe development process in all the most real and visceral ways.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's not all pretty.
In fact, it's usually not pretty until it's really gorgeous.
Yes. So, you know, some of our recipes turn into videos. This is a series in which the recipe and the video are happening at the same time.
Totally.
Which adds a whole other dynamic to the exercise of development.
Totally. And I am not one to shy away from a challenge, generally speaking. And there are a lot of recipes where I would have had an easier time, but I was like, I'm going to pick this thing that can be done so many ways. And I went into it with the idea that part of my development process would be trying all of the different ways.
First up is a cooked filling that gets chilled. It is my go-to lemon curd recipe, thickened a little bit with starch. Second method I'm going to try is key lime pie style, which is sweetened condensed milk, egg yolks, and citrus juice. It is a standard key lime pie filling made with lemons instead, poured into the crust, baked, and then chilled. The third method is a twice-cooked filling. The exact same recipe as the first lemon curd I made, but without the starch, because instead of putting it in the fridge to firm up, we're gonna bake it. The fourth method is a raw filling made in a food processor, then baked. It's based on a lemon.
I really got it into my head that like I had to, in order to like be a completist of this recipe, do a version of a lemon bar every way that a lemon bar could be done in order to have that influence and shape my ultimate decision. And like what ended up happening is like a couple of different paths seems right. And so we tried to mush them together and, you know, hijinks ensued. But I also think like when we're doing a recipe like a lemon bar in this test kitchen, unless you're doing like the ultimate best lemon bar, It should solve a problem. So we wanted to solve the issue of not having to do the twice-cooked curd and not having to do all these different laborious steps. If all I wanted to do was make a lemon bar the way that is tried and true and everyone has made lemon bars forever, this would have been a very short and very uninteresting video. But I really wanted to do something different, and that is what led us to this.
Yeah, and we're going to get into the specifics of what exactly you did in a moment and your kind of SOS moments. But what I want to just level set for folks out there in terms of the problem that Kendra was trying to solve is, so that kind of lemon bar that I grew up with and that I sold many of them, you know, when I was a teenager, that lemon bar is the style that is very often shortbread pre-cooked base, which then has a mixture of, let's call it kind of raw egg, sugar, flour, or some other starchy element, lemon juice, lemon zest, poured onto it, and then it's baked. And what we've found in the past is that when you put raw flour into a preparation like that, you get this little bit of stickiness in the texture, an unpleasant gumminess, which I can think back and identify in those lemon bars. So what I've always wanted to do is develop a recipe that gets rid of that kind of gummy consistency, but without having to make it a hugely steppy process, making a stovetop curd, transferring it to a prepared pastry base, and then having to bake it again. So this recipe was one that I felt a lot of personal investment in, and in a funny way was kind of one of my culinary white whales.
Super effortful. And in the break, I talked to Chris Morocco, and he was like, all my life I have tried to make a lemon bar recipe that doesn't involve being twice cooked, and I've never succeeded.
It is true that the first thing that you told me was like, I have never been able to make it work not like that. And I was like, okay, here I go to make a video where I'm trying to make it work not like that. But part of it was I love lemon curd, like the product lemon curd as a filling for cakes. I love it so, so, so much that I felt like I couldn't rely on it for this recipe. I had to do something else. It seemed like it couldn't be the way towards the perfect lemon bar.
Well, and what's involved in making a lemon curd this way that you're talking about is very often a double boiler. It's a very slow cook.
And people get squidgy about it because you can scramble some eggs. Yeah, exactly. Slow cooking the egg and adding all of this acid to it. And people are worried about clumps. And then you have to pour it through a strainer to make sure you have no clumps and all these things. To me, it seemed like if that is required to make a lemon bar, that can't be the best route.
Well, and I have seen that perform really well
of
in a
course.
Lemon bar.
Yeah.
That was, from a technical standpoint, the best lemon bar I've ever had or ever made.
Right. Yeah. It's like if I ran a bakery, that's the kind of lemon bar I would sell. But I am not making a product where people buy the product. I am making a recipe where people replicate the recipe at home. So
right.
I have to be thinking about something different.
Exactly. And we've seen time and time again, you know, the more interventions you perform in a recipe, unfortunately, it can have the consequence of just giving people reasons not to make something.
Yeah.
They just don't want to follow you there.
Right. When people come over and I cook for them, or when I have a dinner party or whatever, I permit myself to cook in a way that I would never cook at work, because I would never tell someone, grate an almond. But I will make a salad.
Because I would never let you say,
because you would be like, you're fired.
Grate an almond.
But truly, I will do that at home. But it's a different style of thing.
Yeah. And so you basically set out to create a lemon bar that would ideally be a stirred together mixture.
Correct.
That would just be poured in its raw state onto a cooked shortbread base and then baked.
Correct. Yeah. I wanted you to make your crust, bake that off. While it's baking, just mix a bunch of stuff together in a bowl by hand, pour that on top of the crust when it comes out of the oven, put all of that back into the oven, and then be done. To me, that seems simplest.
How'd that go?
Badly. It went, I'll tell you what, it went badly. For a lot of reasons, there are so many things about lemon bars that I didn't realize were possible. I hadn't considered the importance of the temperature of the crust when you pour the mixture on top of it. So pouring my mixture over completely cooled crusts made everything go haywire because the crusts weren't warm, and that is apparently central to lemon bar making. Of course, that would be what someone at home would be doing. People are going to do it back to back, but me, as a developer, I was like trying to have 15 crusts ready to go so that I could go bam, bam, bam. and instead it flipped my lemon bars upside down. I didn't know that was
literally
possible.
So the filling was running underneath the crust.
Correct.
And setting underneath the crust.
Yes. And I didn't even know that that was possible. So when it came out of the oven, I was like, what dark magic? Like, how?
You were scraping the little bit of, like, kind of souffled mixture off the top of the crust. Just like, what fresh hell is this?
How did this occur? And then I Googled my lemon bars upside down, and I got, like, 100 million hits. Like, there's, like, a Reddit page called, like, r/upside down lemon bars. Like, people's lemon bars go upside down all the time. And this is why. It's because their crust isn't warm enough that the filling stays on top. Basically, when the crust is warm, it basically starts to cook the filling immediately. The filling is starting to set as soon as it hits that warm crust. So it's not rushing underneath, you know, as a viscous liquid. And I felt better knowing that we are legion, people whose lemon bars go upside down, but it was still harrowing.
All right, I'm going to 8 minutes and 20 seconds. This is after you've done that first bake of 4 different versions of lemon bars, and you're deciding what your next step is going to be.
I'm going to attempt a whisk in a bowl, pour it on, and bake method. So this style, but no sweetened condensed milk. This style, but no food processor. To yield something that tastes more like this. Is it possible?
Her arms are like moving wildly about the multiple iterations that are arrayed before her. Just FYI. Hold on.
We don't know, but I'm very excited to just like get one banged out and see what it will be.
So what I want to underline with that clip is you made 4 versions right off the bat, all indicative of very different styles of making a lemon bar. None of them was like a true failure.
Correct. Yeah, they were all good tasting.
They all had different attributes that made them interesting. The one with sweetened condensed milk, like the dairy kind of overrode the lemon in an unhelpful way. You know, the one that was cooked on the stovetop and then set in the oven on the pastry base. Performed well, but again, it wasn't quite the brief.
Right. The one where I just made the curd, poured it on, and we refrigerated it was so delicious, but it was so smushy that the top didn't harden and set to the point where I felt like you could stack it in the Tupperware. All these things to consider.
Yeah, it becomes just like an additional consideration. And what I want to point out is when we give each other feedback, it's very rarely that like we're telling somebody no.
Right.
Or that we're telling somebody you need to do dot, dot, dot. It is incumbent on each recipe developer to amalgamate all of the feedback they are given, all of the information they have, and decide on a direction that takes into account all of the feedback that they've received.
It's important because often you're given literally conflicting feedback from people. Someone will be like, I thought it was a little too salty. And someone will be like, I thought you could probably add another teaspoon. And then you just have to figure it out.
Totally. And I think the visibility and the transparency around what it means to all gather 2 times a day when we're in the kitchen together to taste things and to be responding to the same dish.
Yeah. And the people who work in the test kitchen who are the ones who give me this feedback are the people who I would trust with my life with regards to these recipes. Like during the pandemic, cooking for my husband and being like, what do you think? And him being like, it's good. And I was like, get out of my house. Like, that's not feedback. I need some information.
That's what I mean. It's like you give hungry editors cookies at one. And, you know, it takes some pretty stiff resolve to be able to see through the fact that, like, it's a pretty good cookie to question how could it be better.
Right. And we say that all the time, too. Sometimes you are the one who has to bring fish to the tasting when someone else brought mac and cheese and someone else brought a cake. And it's like, sorry, everyone who's eating your fish is going to be like, it's good. But everyone who's eating the mac and cheese is going to be like, this is the best. And that's because it's mac and cheese. But that doesn't mean your fish doesn't require the same amount of attention.
And that's why we have to have mac and cheese only tasting days. All right. We're at 10 minutes and 45 seconds.
We had no idea what would happen. And this is what happened. This sort of very gooey, very browned thing. Look, this skin that just fully comes off. Ew.
There is this brown skin, which is like some combination of like egg protein, sugar,
yeah,
air.
Yeah, it was so bizarre. I was obsessed with this idea of like getting a lot of air into the eggs, like whipping the eggs with a lot of sugar. And I don't know why I got obsessed with that idea. I think because I do it in cookies and stuff. So I was whipping these eggs really hard. And then when I was reading about it that night, because of course I went home and was like, help, and took to the internet. And it turns out that that's like the opposite. You actually want to whisk your eggs for a lemon bar as little as possible, because all the air that you add into it, that's what like escapes when it's cooking and adds all these weird things on the top of your bar, whether it's like bubbles that burst out the top and make the top all like pockmarked and strange, or like cause this weird film to like set over the top. It's all the result of too much air in the mixture.
So here, this was maybe my favorite.
Like, I don't, that's not, this isn't food.
What is that on top?
What is that on top? Great question. Like what's crazy is like, that is the crust. Right underneath this is the crust, because all of the filling has gone to the sides. Everyone watching this is gonna be like, how did she get this job? Why does she get to work at Bon Appetit if this is what she does? It's a great question.
No, but Kendra, you don't understand. Like, when I was like watching this, I was just like, you know what? You are wearing this so lightly and approaching this with like such an extreme of humility. And you're somebody who, listen, you usually are very intent, very direct, mm-hmm. right? You kind of call things like you see them.
Correct.
Right? And yet you are not breaking down when faced with these failures.
No. I just don't think it didn't feel possible. Like, there had to be a lemon bar at the end of this, you know? There just had to be. And so it was like, okay, another one for the compost bin. Let's try it again.
We're going to take another break. When we get back, how Kendra, spoiler alert, stuck the landing with the help of our incredible video production team. Hey listeners, Chris Morocco here. If you find yourself in a dinner crisis, the Epicurious app comes to the rescue. Not only will you unlock over 50,000 recipes from Bon Appetit and Epicurious, but you'll also receive daily personalized recommendations based on your unique preferences and dietary needs. Head to the Apple App Store and download the Epicurious app to kickstart your 7-day free trial today. Don't miss out on this culinary adventure. Start your free trial and let the Epicurious app be your kitchen hero. Happy cooking. And we are back. So, Kendra, the process of developing a recipe for this video series is 2 days long. So, after you left the test kitchen on day one, what did you do?
I went home and obviously like collapsed on the couch and was like, help, how can I be better at this tomorrow? And just did a lot of Googling. Like, there are all sorts of weird forums across the internet where people ask baking questions. There's all sorts of stuff where you Google like lemon bars, no, and then Google will fill in like flour. And then you can read about like recipes for lemon bars that don't have flour, or lemon bars, no butter, lemon bars, no milk, whatever. Mostly people are Googling that when it's because they want to make lemon bars, but they don't have an ingredient on hand. But I'm trying to figure out like how best to manipulate my ingredients list. So I'm seeing if someone's like, I didn't have flour, so I did XYZ thing instead. I just like to have that in the back of my mind so I know what to reference in terms of making up the jigsaw puzzle of how everything fits together. And I don't like to then be beholden to any of the things so strictly that I read, but just to be armed with all of that knowledge to come in the next day and try to use it to help fuel my next decision-making process.
Okay, so now we're at the beginning of day two. And there was a lot of kind of moves that ended up being relatively small.
Yeah.
Honestly, it seems, from where you are here. Like, what I think is fascinating is, like, where we are right now, 12 minutes in. It's only half the video.
Yeah.
But it seems very bleak.
Yeah.
But ultimately, what you did from here was what? Will you paraphrase? It was like you went back to the milk.
Right. So I was trying to do a version without any added starches. And so then I went back to the drawing board, and then I decided, what if instead I use whole milk as my dairy moment here and not butter at all? I tried to do a version where I used powdered sugar in place of some of the granulated sugar, because powdered sugar is made with cornstarch or potato starch or tapioca starch, depending on the brand that you buy. So I thought, oh, maybe that would do some sweetness and also do the stabilizing that I need from the starch. So that when I started day two, those were my two main levers that I felt like I was going to be pulling. And I was literally like, it's so funny to watch this back, because it was the matter of like a single tablespoon. It was like between
three or four.
Yeah, three tablespoons or four. And when something went horribly wrong with three tablespoons, I was like, it's because it has to be four tablespoons. And when I talked to Hannah, she was like, no, it doesn't. It would not go upside down just from the difference of one tablespoon of flour. Something else is at play here. And she was right, of course. But at the time, I was like, any little difference, that's the other problem.
What was
with
it? Was it the temperature of the crust?
Yeah, it was definitely the temperature of the crust.
Yeah.
But the problem that I have is that I'm not scientific. I will make like four changes to a recipe between iterations, which means that there is not one variable difference. And so when something goes awry, it could have been any of the things.
In a perfect world, we would change one variable at a time.
Totally.
Right? But that's not an efficient way to develop. So often we're working on multiple axes, sort of working with multiple ingredients at once and forming hypotheses about what actually is making pivotal changes
from
one version to the next.
And when I am making those changes, it's usually to something savory or whatever, where it's less pivotal that like things be the same. In baking, which is so much more of a science, one small change can result in like a massive textural difference or a massive taste difference. So it is better to be more scientific in baking, and you can be a little bit more like artsy fluid in the savory cooking part of things. I just decided to throw caution to the wind with this one.
Fair. Okay. I found this next clip just fascinating and heartbreaking. Okay.
We are having a day. I opened up the oven at our time. It was soup. It was totally sloshy liquid. The gas went out. The ovens got fucked up.
Oh my God, I forgot this even happened.
It was not the right temperature anymore.
Part of this wasn't even my fault.
Cranked it and got it to set. And it looks honestly fine, but not perfect, because it had this weird blip of not the right temperature in the middle.
I forgot that this happened.
We would love to think that we control all the variables, but ultimately we don't.
That was a crazy day. And my thing wasn't even the worst thing that got ruined. Like three or four other people were developing stuff in the kitchen, like not on camera, and their stuff got fully ruined because the gas went out in all of our ovens.
So this was an equipment failure that was beyond our control. It still somehow kind of worked.
Once it got back, I just like cranked the heat to like, I think like 400 and like slammed it to the finish line so that we could at least assess.
I feel like one thing that I remember you saying to me, I'd seen you on day one of this video. I didn't see you on day two. And in one of your darker moments on day two, you said you were really, by that point, I think you were just probably exhausted by the whole exercise, which is totally fair and valid. But you mentioned Kevin Dynia in particular, who's one of our camera guys, wonderful director of photography. What did he say to you?
I was in a dark place. I think I had made 11 trays of lemon bars at that point, and I really thought that I did not have another tray in me. The one that we made that we said was going to be our final one got screwed up. And like the timing was like we were supposed to be done for the day exactly 40 minutes from now. And I knew exactly what I had to do, but like there, it just didn't feel like it would be possible for us to do it in the time allotment. And I was just like feeling dejected. And he was like, we can stay, just like rock this one out. You can do it one more and you're going to nail it. And I was like, okay, like I have the support of these people who have like watched me flail for at this point 48 hours. I owe it to them to just like bang out this bomb ass tray of lemon bars right now. And I just zoomed around the kitchen and like pulled it all together and baked it off, and it came out great.
And I want to really underline the fact that, okay, in the test kitchen, just for, you know, any old recipe, we rely on each other, meaning the food editors lean on each other for support and guidance and feedback. When you step into the video space, a whole different set of processes take over.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, those processes are born of like different teams, operations. You know, the video team, the folks who are behind the cameras, they are such a big part of these productions.
Of course, yeah. They're asking questions, they ask such vital questions where it's like, they're not food people necessarily. So sometimes they're like, why are you doing that? And you have to think for a second, why am I doing that? Why did I make this choice?
I mean, there's so many great people who work across video, but Kevin is somebody who's been there for years. And when Kendra said that, you know, it was really Kevin's kind of prodding, like, hey, can we just do this one more time and get this done? Really filled my heart with so much warmth and love and admiration for the way that our teams work together, because like, we rely on them, they rely on us. These folks are carrying 20-pound cameras around for like days at a time, trying to capture what we're doing. And they are a huge part of what goes into these recipes that appear on video. And I just love that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so nice to have everybody there because they are like, there's a skill level for everybody's job in that room. And we both know we couldn't step into the other person's role, but I'm the one who's like flailing in front of a camera, and they are so kind about how my crazy day has gone. And they were so supportive and ate all of my failed bars throughout the day, very kindly telling me, you know, it looks crazy, but it tastes really good. And I'd be like, I needed to hear that. Thank you so much. They're the best.
I just love that. All right. Final clip.
The roller coaster you've been on today.
I really have been.
Oh my gosh. First of all, what a thing of beauty.
Really nice.
Yeah. Oh, that's here. A 3-to-1 ratio right there. Look at her jiggle. Oh my God. I love how rounded the lemon flavor is, but you still get the punchy tart that you want out of a lemon bar.
So Hannah's referencing 3-to-1 ratio, meaning kind of 3 parts filling
yeah.
to 1 part crust. This lemon filling is pillowy. It's supple. It stands high off of that crust. It's not artificially yellow.
Sure.
But it's very beautiful. I don't even know, like, what's, like, the sort of artful way of describing the color yellow.
Sunny.
It's sunny. It's, like, mm-hmm. a very golden, warm yellow. These things are beautiful. And you solved the problem you set out to solve. These are lemon bars that don't have to be twice cooked. You don't have to make a curd. They're stackable. You did it.
I'm proud of them. I went back in my Instagram story archive, and I found this photo, which I posted on my Instagram story on September 7th, 2023. I am on the floor next to my bicycle, and this is what I have written. Hello from the Condé Nast bike room. I have had the most harrowing 2 days of baking, and unfortunately, it was all captured on camera and will be coming to a YouTube near you. One can only hope the editors frame my roller coaster as a hero's journey. And honestly, the editors did me a solid because while I did kind of go through it, I feel like it has all of the framing of a 3-act play.
Yeah.
And we come out on top in the end.
Totally. Well, I'm so glad to have been able to shine some light on what the process is like and what goes on behind the scenes. Hero's journey indeed.
Love it. Thank you for playing this back to me. It's such a joy.
If you have a dinner emergency on your hands, write to us at dinnersos@bonappetit.com or leave us a voice message at 212-286-SOS1. That's 212-286-7071. And if you've tried this recipe, whether it turned out great or not so great, let us know. We want to hear about how it went for you at home. That's part of the process, too. You can find the recipe for Kendra's foolproof lemon bars on the Epicurious app brought to you by Condé Nast. Just search Epicurious in the App Store and download today. And make sure you check out her How I Developed video at youtube.com/bonappetit. It is titled, appropriately, Developing These Perfect Lemon Bars Nearly Broke Me. That is the title. If you enjoy this episode, please give us a rating and review on your podcast app of choice. And hit the follow button so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening to Dinner SOS. I'm your host, Chris Morocco. My co-host this week is Kendra Vaculin. Our producer is Michelle O'Brien. Peyton Hayes is our associate producer. Cameron Foos is our assistant producer. Jake Loomis is our studio engineer. Amar Lal mixed this episode. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Next week, Gabe is an Australian expat living in Italy. Last year, her neighbors, who are American, invited her over for a Thanksgiving dinner. So Gabe wants to return the hosting favor.
I want to pay homage to your home country, but what the hell is that? What typifies an American meal?
Oh, we've got a tasty little ad here. Now this
You'd
worked out.
You think we would get away to watch our own videos with no ads?
Nope,
but
nobody's safe.
Tell me about your mama's kitchen.
This teeny tiny little room was where we did everything. We grew up there. We became teenagers, adults in that small space.
I'm Michelle Norris. The kitchen is usually the heartbeat of our homes. It's the place where we're nourished physically and spiritually. It's where the people we love most chased away life's furies with skillets and spatulas.
I love you. I really care about you. Those words don't come naturally. But what you can do is hand someone a corned beef sandwich that's the size of your head. And that means the same thing.
Every week, I'm serving up a new episode of this Audible original podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. They're available anywhere you listen.